So welcome to this episode of Canadian Turf Talks. I'm Dr. Sarah Stricker from the Guelph Turf Grass Institute, and I'm joined here by my co-host, Jason.
I'm Jason Haynes, and I'm the superintendent at the Lynx course at Cabot Cape Breton.
And today we have on the call, our guest is Mike Sheedle from Green Horizon Sod Farms in Ontario. Now, you have multiple sod farms across Ontario. Where are your locations, Mike?
Yeah, so we're spread out around the Tri-Cities for our Cambridge division. And then we also have an operation in Hamilton that looks after the more of the GTA down to the Niagara market. And then we are west in London, and that farm looks after our London West market. And then we have a specialty turf farm in Burford.
I guess like the reasons that you're spread out in multiple locations is mostly just like transport logistics. Or is it, what's the reason for that?
I think there are probably a lot of reasons that went into that. So we're a family owned and operated business. So our first farm was in Cambridge. And then as the second generation got to working age, there was two brothers. So that was my dad and my uncle. There was kind of too many cooks in the kitchen. So we had to expand, and that's where we expanded down to Hamilton. And Steve went down to Hamilton and Ron stayed in Cambridge. And that gave us a logistical edge by being able to service GTA and surrounding market from two different production facilities. So I think logistics was a big part of it. And then expanding out to London, being able to be closer to market on the west side of Southern Ontario there. But just geographical areas and soil types and different weather patterns is a part of it as well. Sod farming is the product is a very unique product, that it's a living thing that needs to be ready for market every day. And that's very difficult to do. And with having the different geographical areas gives us a little bit of flexibility if we were to have to pull from one production facility or another. So I wouldn't say that it was a 30-year master plan, but it definitely has worked in our favor to be spread out the way that we are.
Now, so you're a third generation sod farmer. How many members of your family are still involved in the sod farm?
Yeah, so we definitely we used to have a lot of family members. So my grandparents started the business. So Richard and Shirley Sheedle, grandma and grandpa to me, and then from there the generation below. So the second generation, there was a lot involved. A couple uncles, a couple aunts, my parents. So that generation was very, very involved. And now today, myself and my dad, Steve, are really the last two. And my mom, Christine. So the three of us are operating doing the daily operations. So we used to have upwards of 10 family members, and now we're kind of down to three.
I think that's the case in a lot of farming families, that it used to be a concern of like, oh, do we split the farm across multiple family members who want to inherit it? But now it's coming down to there's actually fewer family members that want to inherit it. I wonder if that's the same in your situation.
Yeah, I mean, for my generation, I'm the only one doing the sod farming end of things. And you really got to love it. You know, being in the green space industry, you're dealing with a living crop. That's also dying. You know, if it's living, it can be dying. So it's 7 days a week, it's dying, and you know, every single month. So you really, really gotta love it, because it's a 24/7, you know, twice on Sunday type of career. So it's not just a business. It has to be your hobby. It has to be your whole identity to be successful at it. So I think that's a tricky pass in farming families to have that passion and have that drive move down, because it's not just the business. It's your whole identity.
Yeah. You can't just like, you know, take a month off. The grass doesn't stop growing.
you can't take a day off. You can't, not a month off.
Well, that's it. Like it's and for a lot of people, that's a deal breaker.
And things get away so quick as well. You know, in golf, it's similar that if you don't manage that green, or if you don't manage that field properly in our world, and especially because we're dry land farming, if you go sideways, you may never get the opportunity that year to bring it back into shape.
So dry land means it's not irrigated?
Yeah, most of our production farms are dry land farms. We do have some fields in Cambridge that are underwater, under irrigation. But to manage just the volume of acreage that we're doing, it just would not be viable to be entirely underwater. So most of it is dry land farming.
Wow.
That's surprising. Yeah. I mean, so on the areas that you do irrigate, how are you irrigating that? Is that center pivot?
Most of it is center pivot. And that kind of came from the soil type. So it's a really sandy soil in the Cambridge area here, sandy and rocky. So really very low water holding capacity. And without water on those particular fields, they would almost not be viable at all. That being said, at our Burford farm, that is 100% under irrigation. Most of it is travelers. So a traveler with a boom or with a gun, they're, 1,000 foot to 1,400 foot travelers that shoot 120 to 280 feet, depending on the configuration you have. And that whole farm is underwater because it's specialty turf like bent grasses and different types of sports field blends. That needs to be micromanaged more. But all of our production Kentucky bluegrass, most of it is dry land.
So we basically already touched on this, but like, can you walk us through like how sod is grown from start to finish? Like what time, what's the difference between a dry land and a underwater field? How does that?
Yeah. I mean, it's you want to take 1 minute close notes or take the whole hour?
I'm still learning. I need somebody to tell me how to grow sod.
I think most of the people listening are turf professionals, so you don't need to get into too much detail. But if you're talking to a golf course superintendent, how would you explain it?
Yeah, so growing sod, I guess the first thing I would say is that growing sod is a lot different than maintaining grass. Maintaining grass, and you're trying to maintain a dense growing or playable surface or usable surface. You already have the root system there. You already have the top end growth. So you're just in a maintenance mode, very different than growing and trying to establish from, I guess, seed. So for us, it's a 2 to 3 year process on our dry land farming. That variable is because of the weather. Depending on the type of years that you're having, growing seasons you're having, you could have grass ready in that 18 to 24 month range. But if you don't have favorable growing seasons, then you're more into that 24 month plus. And once you harvest it off, there's a process to work up the soil and replant. So from plant to plant, we're typically 3 years. Whereas plant to harvest is, in that 2 to 3 year mark. So that the preparation pre-seeding is kind of that's everybody's secret mac sauce of how they prepare the soil till pre-seeding, because it's so, so important. That soil profile that you're working with is just the ideal germination and growing soil profile for that crop to grow for the next couple of years. So we go from, if you were to harvest the field, it's extremely compacted. Transport trucks are driving in the field. So from there, there's deep tillage tools that will bring out compaction, 16 to 20 inches deep. And then from there, you're working it up, starting from that 16 inches, bringing it all the way up to a 2-inch pan-ish. And then there's a major land leveling process. When you think of traditional farming, like a big combine that might have a 20-foot plus head, and on that head, it might have a flexible blade that can manage an inconsistency in the field. It might be able to handle a 4-inch type of dip in the field versus a sod harvester. When you get that roll of sod, it's cut extremely thin and it's 2 feet wide. So that sod harvesting equipment is extremely detailed. If you have even a 1 inch of a ripple in the soil profile, it's not going to work. You're going to have scalp rolls and they're just going to be no good. So that land leveling process is again, that's like the secret mac sauce. And then from there, you got that soil tilth, and then you're planting into it. It's germinating. You're through your fertilizer and your herbicide, pesticide regimes and mowing regimes, bringing it to readiness to marketable turf grass. A lot of mowing passes and a lot of fertilizing and spraying. Mowing is another huge aspect of it, especially growing. Same thing with maintaining, but with growing specifically, you know, every minute of the day that grass can be spending time in growing and expanding itself and being healthy versus it could be spending every minute repairing itself and repairing the damage that you've done from a bad mowing application. So there's a lot that goes into it, and timing with Mother Nature, working with Mother Nature instead of against.
Now, do you rotate with another crop, or is it just turf and then till and then re-prepare and turf again?
We do rotation with soybean and corn, but we also do a lot of cover cropping, and sod farming is very unique. When you drive out into the countryside in Southern Ontario, you see wall to wall corn, soybean, wheat. It's a lot of row crop. And one of the unfortunate downsides to those crops is that you have a crop that you're going to harvest that's in the field essentially the entire growing season. So you don't really have an opportunity. You don't have a great opportunity for utilizing cover crops. And don't get me wrong, you do. And we do cover crop within our row crop regime as well. But you got to do winter type of regimes. And you just have a little less opportunity. Mm-hmm. With our sod crop, for example, sometimes our crop might come off in August, like harvested in August or September, and it might not get replanted until the following August. So we have that entire springs or fall, spring, and portion of summer that we could have another plant in there. So we do a lot of cover cropping in our regime that gets ultimately tilled back into the soil. And we found that to be a major, major benefit for long term and short term. Mm. That's a big deal in the agricultural world, is that, you know, there's so many things that we could be doing that make long term sense. However, if it doesn't make short term sense, you're never going to make it to the long term situation. And I think we're one of the fortunate crops that we can do those things that, you know, aid to the long term, but also can pencil in and make sense.
Well, and there, I have heard some people have this conception that because you're harvesting sod, you're basically taking away a layer of topsoil every time. So maybe the cover crop and till back in like negates that, or I don't know, what have you seen in your experience?
Yeah. I mean, we get that misconception all the time. I mean, that's a question that I always get hit with. And you know, we're a sod farm, but we are also a row crop farmer. You know, we row crop a couple thousand acres as well. And any day I would rather put sod in the field than row crop. And row crop, like when you compare farming in general is hard on the soil. And, you know, I'm a farmer, you know, inside and out, 110%. And I think we could be naive to think that it's not. You know, if you look at what Mother Nature does in our absence, it's not monocultures. It is a biodiverse floor. It's always covered with organic matter or plants. You know, there's never a situation that you have bare dirt out there. So you look at all those different aspects that happen naturally, and then you look at the farming practices that are out there, and it's a very wide contrast. And, you know, so when you look at sod, for example, that's a crop that is covering the soil, totally covered in an organic matter and green cover for 3 years, is tilled under, is either cover cropped or put back into a grass right away. So you're really only having open soil for a very short period of time. It could be, you know, a couple months at maximum. And when you have that open soil, you got wind erosion, water erosion. You're losing your nutrients because it's baking in the sun. You're losing that microbiology, the bacteria that's in the soil that is supposed to have organic matter to be living on and roots to be living on and you know, moisture retention and making organic matter. But when you have nothing in there, that whole ecosystem essentially dies over time. So, you know, I'm a firm believer that having something growing in the field, that's number one. You need to have an ecosystem out there to feed your microbiology. So with sod, just in its nature, you know, you're covered for longer. The other aspect of sod that I think is overlooked is that when we're mowing our fields, you know, we're essentially harvesting. We are harvesting that rain, harvesting that sun. And when we're mowing those fields three times a week, four times a week, when we're growing, you know, we've done measurements on it and studies on it, and we feel like we're making, you know, upwards of 20 feet of grass clippings over a crop life cycle, you know, 20 feet of grass clippings that are ultimately biodegrading into the soil, you know, so that's creating organic matter. And what we have found is that our fields that are sod fields, you know, 40 plus years, we have higher organic matter in those fields than we do in our row crop fields. Like a good example in a farming aspect is lots of fields have fence rows, right? That you see where you got trees and shrubbery in between some fields. And sometimes those get taken out and put into production. It's interesting. If you do a soil sample of those fence rows, you'll find organic matter percentages, you know, in the 7, 8, you know, even 10% in some areas.
Wow.
Whereas if you were to do a soil test for organic matter in most Southern Ontario farm fields, you're in the 1, maybe 3% organic matter range. And, you know, that's just clear that is depleted from whenever it was a forest. And when we do our sod fields versus our traditional row crop fields, because we have some fields that are, you know, they're just not suitable for sod. You know, we're down to that 1, 1.5, you know, 2% is good versus our long-term sod fields are in that higher threes, you know, some of them at the 4%, but mostly in that mid to high threes. And it is a meaningful difference when you look at it that way.
Yeah.
So on the contrary of what is thought out there, I'm very much that sod as a crop is improving soil health, and we have the ability to do the right practices that we need to do to not just make it a net neutral, but make it a net positive versus row crop and cash crop, unfortunately, doesn't. And that's a major, major issue. You know, in my generation, like we got to figure that out. You know, if I look at, you know, two generations before me, I don't know what the right way to put it, because it's not like they weren't productive, but they were productive in their times, but they're not productive comparative to now. You know, back then, a 30 bushel corn crop was, you're doing good. Where today we're doing 200 bushel corn crops, you know, 9 times what grandpa was doing on the same piece of dirt and using bigger machinery and XYZ. So that generation, they just didn't have the capacity to do a lot of bad. You know what I mean? If that makes sense. You know, where now I look at my generation of farming, you know, they're going to be forced to. We're going to be forced to. That if you're not looking after your soil health, your fields are not going to be working for you. And I feel fortunate with what we do with our fields and our crops that we are really good. But it's, you know, we're not talking about just ourselves, but the whole industry as a whole.
Oh man, you just said like so many really cool things. going back to the organic matter thing, I mean, that's something I never really considered. Although, I mean, I'm aware of studies and projects that have used grasses or grasslands to rebuild soil organic matter. And it's kind of funny for you from an agricultural standpoint, the organic matter is a good thing. And it's kind of funny, as soon as you take that sod off your field and put it in a golf course or a turf grass setting, all of a sudden the organic matter that the grass is really good at making is a problem. And I kind of find that a little bit funny, because I go to a great extent or a great effort to stop the grass from making organic matter. Any, you know, dead or non-living plant material in the soil.
I mean, in essence, you know, what is the difference between subgrade soils that don't grow anything and topsoil? And, you know, a major part of that is the byproducts of organic matter, whether it be organic matter in itself or all the micronutrients and macronutrients that come out of the decomposition of organic matter. It's a pretty, you know, circle of life situation. You know, things live, things die. That energy is going into the soil as organic matter, and that's what we all live on. So if you don't have it, nothing's working.
I think the turf gas industry needs to, like, you know, get you as their spokesperson, because I mean, grass just seems to have kind of a bad name, although I think that's changing slightly lately. But it's like everybody's against grass, but it's like the best thing. I mean, really, it is. Like, it, for the soils, for everything else, like, let's replace it with a rock garden.
Yeah.
Or mulch.
I could talk about this all day about it all. Like, I think, you know, everybody, and don't get me wrong, like, I love all nature, but like, everybody, you know, trees are like that number one that, you know, trees are good for the climate and good for sequestering carbon and producing oxygen. And like everybody thinks about like a forest and a treed area, and trees are great. You know, trees are 10 out of 10. Great. But when you look at that tree that took 100 years and you look at that trunk and those branches and all that carbon, you know, that is what it is. Like that tree is carbon, and it took 100 years to put on that mass. Well, you look at 100 years of a meadow, and it's like exponentially more than what that tree did on that same square footage. I'm not the scientist, but you know, the oxygen creating and the carbon sequestering of a meadow field of a grass area versus a forest area, it's amazing how similar, or you know, depending on the type of trees and the type of grass, where grass areas can even outperform what everybody would picture as a forest. You know, a forest where meadowlands are phenomenal, producing organic matter ultimately and harvesting carbon.
Speaking of you being a spokesperson for the turf industry, you are actually already a spokesperson, kind of. You're the president of the Ontario Nursery Sod Growers Association. Could you tell us more about that and what the goals of that organization are?
Yeah, so the NSGA Nursery Sod Growers, NSGAO, I guess, Nursery Sod Growers Ontario, is predominantly a sod farmer group. It's a non-for-profit association that represents the Ontario sod market. It's also affiliated members within that support that industry. But what we do as an association, you know, we're the nucleus, you know, the spokesperson, I guess, or the point person for the turf grass sod industry. As a body, I mean, we're working with Landscape Ontario. We're working with OMAFRA, you know, to try to improve our industry as a whole. I think that we play an important part with OMAFRA, because when you look at the turf grass industry as a whole, we're the only ones that are producing the product. So that's a meaningful thing when it comes to the OMAFRA, the agricultural based aspect. Whereas what we create, there's a lot of value add down the road, all the whole golf course industry, the whole sports field industry, landscape industry. So for that whole industry to have a way into OMAFRA is important. You know, so we're there to help try to steer the ship in the right direction, you know, being that voice with the municipalities, you know, and landscape architects on how to utilize green space within your urban developments, and specifically sod. You know, so it's an ongoing thing, ongoing battle. As we know, you know, green space is becoming harder and harder to come by within our urban developments.
Yeah. And for any of our listeners who are not in Ontario, OMAFRA is the acronym that we use to talk about the Ontario Ministry of Agriculture. And, you know, we used to have what was called the turf grass specialist, a government employee that was specialized in turf and was supporting that. That role hasn't really been renewed in the past, six years, something like that. The Ministry of Ag has basically said to us in no uncertain terms, the only thing that they consider agriculture is sod and seed, which I think is absolutely crazy, because if we don't support the lawn care industry and the golf industry, what does the sod industry feed, right? It's a whole system.
So that's a great point that you brought up there. And that's one thing that the NSGA is doing right now, is we're lobbying and working with a third party to try to, I guess, convince OMAFRA that this is a meaningful position that needs to be reinstated, and look at all these different industries that utilize this resource and depend on the support of this resource. So that's definitely one piece of what the NSGA is doing.
Okay, I'm just want to go back. Sorry, the golf course superintendent in me has got to know. You said you mow your grass 3 or 4 times a week. How many acres of grass are you mowing each time?
So I guess Green Horizons, we have about 6,000 acres in production, but that's not all in sod at all at any given time, but about 4,000 acres at any given time will be in sod. So 4,000 acres three times a week. It's a lot of mowing.
That, like, I thought my 65 acres of fairways twice a week was a lot. So how many mowers and like what kind of mowers are you using?
Yeah, so we kind of got the whole gambit when it comes to mowers, but we prefer a reeled mower over a rotary. Is kind of the two natures of the beast. Rotary mowers we find can be good when we have a new stand, like a newly seeded stand that's not, doesn't have the density that a reel mower kind of requires to get that premium cut. So we'll start off with a rotary, and then we may move into our reel mowers within the first year or into the second year. It really depends on the type of growing season we're having. But then the majority of the grass is maintained with a reel mower. So a bed knife reel style, 22 to 26 foot units for the most part. And yeah, each farm has, you know, 6 to 10 units, and they're running every day.
So those are like gang mower towed behind a tractor kind of thing?
Correct.
And I guess the reels must be more economical as far as fuel. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, from a fuel perspective, you need a smaller tractor to run a same width unit. So a 26 foot rotary might require a 100 horse tractor, where a 26 foot reel might require a 50 horse tractor. So definitely a lot less horsepower, which would then relate to less fuel for sure. And a lot less tractor, just overall less everything. But it's more the quality of the job. I alluded to that in the beginning, that, you know, we put really high on the value mark, that every second of every minute of every day, you know, that grass is exerting energy somewhere, and it needs to be growing, not repairing. And when you mow every single time, you're deciding which way it's going. So it's either got a nice premium slice cut. You know, we like to compare it to, if you were to, you know, be going 40 kilometers an hour down a gravel road and fall, and you have road rash on your arm, and how long that takes to repair. Just yourself as a human, your body repairing that, you know, can take weeks, versus if you have a little slit or a clean cut on your arm, you know, it can repair in almost days. And, you know, it's really the same with a grass blade. If you have a dull rotary mower and you just tear the tip of that blade to shreds, and you can just feel it out there that they're just, you know, they're just in pain, and they're not spending the energy on growing, and it's just repairing. So that is probably the biggest principle that goes into our mowing decisions.
And that's on sharpen your blades, everyone. Yeah. Just go out, if you haven't sharpened them this year, go sharpen your blades.
Exactly.
Speaking on the technology and the tools side, has there been any recent advances or changes in the tools that you use? Like, are you using drones or using any kind of computer programming, or what's new to your generation of sod farming?
Yeah, well, a lot. I would say a lot in every aspect, you know, things have improved. I think the utilization of cover crops, like, so maybe not a tool, but a process, is a big deal and a big change. Mm-hmm. When it comes to actual machinery and tools, I mean, the automation of sod harvesting was a huge deal. And that was maybe 15 years ago now, but sod harvesting used to be manual and is now automated. So that was a really big change. Today, talking about from the computer aspect, we used to use some drone technology to scan our fields, but now we've found that like satellite imagery is happening on a well-scheduled basis, you know, multiple times a year, at least in our areas. We're pretty close to market, and I guess built up areas get photoed more. You know, so we utilize those satellite imagery a lot to be able to identify our inventory management, what stage it's at, to see problems from an overall standpoint. And then utilizing information like that, we can now do variable rate fertilizer applications. So that's a new technology where utilizing a shape file in our GPS units, we can go over a field and we can draw, you know, maybe we have a high rate, a medium rate, and a low rate. And depending on the inconsistencies in the field, we can do that variable rate fertilizer application. You know, and I grew up, you know, learning from dad, you know, you put in the clutch going over the hill. So you're driving a little slower and you put it out, putting on a little more fertilizer over those thin areas. And, you know, that's how you did your variable rate application, where today, you know, a professional can, I can do that over 100 fields now without being in the seat, by prescribing that through a shape file and being uploaded into the fertilizer spreader. That's definitely been a big improvement. I mean, the list goes on. Rock picking equipment has improved in a big way. In our Cambridge farm, we mechanically pick rocks. So there's so much here that it's not, you know, the good old, you know, go out rock picking with your bunch of kids and by hand. It's like harvesting a rock crop every year, and there's a lot. So it's all mechanically done. So that technology has improved in a big way. From the sales end, that's all production. Now on the fulfillment end, we've built our own fulfillment software over a lot of years. I think our Agri Order system is 20 years old and updating constantly. And that's a fulfillment. So like a logistics dispatching software, as well as a point of sale and over the phone order taking software, and then reporting aspect to it. So that has given us the ability to logistically, you know, dispatch our loads in the most efficient manner possible, you know, over thousands of orders a day. And it's manageable with a few dispatch managers, instead of in the past, kind of before my time, but in the past, we used to print out our hundreds of orders a day and pin them on a map and, you know, draw strings around the trucking route. And then from there, we would take the invoices and give them to the truck drivers in order of, you know, do it this way. Here's your 20 drops and do it in this manner. You know, that was just, I just couldn't even imagine doing that with what we're doing today, where we have the app on the phone and you can see all your different drops and where you're going. And that has been a major, major game changer in our world, just from the fulfillment and logistics side of things.
So something you just said there kind of just triggered something that's kind of interesting. Maybe it might be one of the only agricultural crops where you're like tilling the soil, planting, maintaining, and harvesting at the same time. Like you're doing all of these things presumably every day.
And selling.
And distributing, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like a tomato farmer doesn't have to worry about packaging and marketing and shipping. And they just like, yeah, come pick up. All right, I'm done.
That's the blessing and the curse of sod farming. I mean, you're in full control of your destiny. You know, we're not selling to a world market or a marketing board or some sort of controlled distribution network. Each individual sod farm, you know, can decide, you know, what's their price, what's their delivery schedule, what's their daily, weekly, monthly offering, you know, so that's great, but it's also extremely tough. You know, there's a reason why farming is the way it is for a lot of crops, because you go through a lot of highs and lows. You know, our crop, just like other crops, you know, we can have 100% yield or we can have 50% yield. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's just a range like that. Could you imagine running a Toyota plant manufacturing cars, and you don't know if this year you're gonna yield 1,000 cars or 500 cars, but your overhead's the same, your factory's the same, everything's the same. And that's what it's like with a farm. You know, you put all in all the same inputs, but Mother Nature decides what you're getting out of it. So that can be tough, very tough.
I mean, often when Mother Nature's making it hard on you, you actually have to put more inputs into it.
Yeah, double down. It's a problem.
Yeah, double-edged sword. It's it's the same thing on a golf course. You know, when the conditions are good, it's often very easy for us to get those conditions. But then when they're bad, we're working like 10 times as hard and the conditions are the worst. And you're just like, this isn't very much fun.
That's right. And that can be difficult. I mean,
now we've kind of tiptoed around this, but I know that you produce specialty sod, and that's creeping bedgrass. Now we always grow, well, most sod in northern countries is Kentucky bluegrass because of the rhizomatous growth and that it knits together. How do you produce creeping bedgrass sod when it's on sand and it doesn't produce that kind of knitting structure.
Yeah. So for our bent grasses and we do some fescues as well that have more of a taproot root growth. We grow it on a biodegradable netting. So we'll prepare the field just like we would with a typical sod crop. But then once it's all completely prepared, we'll go over it with a netting machine, and we'll put that biodegradable netting over the, or sorry, we'll seed the field, and then we put the netting over the field. So that netting is kind of like an artificial, it is biodegradable piece of material, I guess, but it is like an artificial rhizomious and stolon growth. You know, it's creating that strength. So really without that, it would be almost impossible to grow some of these specialty grasses. So that's been a big innovation in the industry as well. I think down south, they do some of these grasses in a slab type of growth. So they don't roll it up into a roll. They cut a 2-foot by 3-foot slab because it doesn't have that tensile strength to make a roll, but it does have just enough to make a slab. So that is another method of it. But for us, we net those type of grasses.
Just asking for a friend, do you grow any velvet bent grass?
Velvet bent grass? I don't think any straight that, no. I mean, our bent grass division, we have our customers that are like our consistent customers and the greens that they have and the teas that they have. So we have those specialty blends for those guys. And then we have our kind of Green Horizons specialty blend, and that's what we carry and that's what we offer. If we were to inventory, you know, what every single golf course has, you know, it would just be impossible essentially for everybody to have their individual blend. So we'll grow on spec. So if a certain course that really loves their blend of bent grass or their varieties that they use, that's something that we can grow on spec for the following year type of deal. So we can negotiate what the project is 2023, plant it, and have it for ready for that course in 2024.
That's pretty cool. You can literally order like right to the cultivar and everything. But like when it comes to your other sods that you don't necessarily have a specific market for, how do you decide what variety you're going to plant? Like, and also, do you start with like perennial ryegrass as a nurse crop, or you go full on Kentucky bluegrass the whole time?
Like, this is for are we still in specialty, or are we
for the majority of sod? Just I'm backtracking here because now you raise some more questions for me.
Yeah, so for the majority of the sod, I mean, our Green Horizons Kentucky bluegrass blend, you know, that's what we promote. We do sell like a secondary camel grass is what we call it, which is an even more drought tolerant and heat stress tolerant type of Kentucky bluegrass. So we do carry both those inventories everywhere, both those products everywhere. But how do we decide what our main blend is? I mean, we do studies, and we're probably one of the only farms that do it, at least to the intensity that we do. We'll bring, so our blends that we have out in production could be 3 or 4 different varieties of grass. So what we'll do is we'll split that out into a monoculture, and we'll plant 1-acre plots of each of those at our specialty farm. You know, we try to get inconsistent plots where we have some knolls and we have some wet areas. So we actually break those out, and we'll also plant, you know, some different varieties that we're interested in that we think we might want to put into our mix down the road. So we'll do that kind of research and development, you know, years ahead of actually incorporating that into our mix, you know, versus just going off an end tip or going off of a hearsay situation. We don't just go off that. We'll listen to that information, but we need to put it into our market in our geographical area, and we need to see its success. So we put a lot of effort into that. And from there, I mean, we're analyzing what the market wants, and that has changed over time. I think, I mean, with this cosmetic ban that's happened, the market doesn't have the tools to you know, to keep that, you know, dark green, perfect lawn like they used to. I think, you know, I don't know if I play the climate change, you know, card, but it does feel like, you know, we have longer strings of hotter days, and we have just more intensity in our weather patterns, and that can make a big difference in the type of varieties that you choose. You know, we live in a very unique area where we have high intensity summers and we have high intensity winters, and there's not a lot of places like that. You know, you go a little bit more north and they might have the high intensity winters, but they don't have the high intensity summers. And you go a little bit more south and they might have higher intensity summers, but not the same in the winter. And if you think about plants, you know, I always like to bring it back to, you know, people, because people understand people. And, you know, how do you feel when it's 35 degrees out? You know, and how do you feel when it's negative 35 degrees out? Well, same thing as your grass out there. And if you were born, you know, closer to the equator and it's always 35 degrees out, you get accustomed to that and you can handle that 35 degrees and you like it. But if you went into negative 35, you would not be able to handle it. Same thing. So here we have those major transitions, and that's tough. So where I'm going with how do we choose our varieties? I would say over time it's changed as the market has changed to try to get that more utilitarian blend that can handle everything, handle the lack of moisture, handle the lack of rain, you know, non-irrigated, handle the heat stress of stringing together, you know, 10 plus days of 35 degrees. You know, that's a major problem that is kind of new to our area. You know, cool season grasses, there's one thing to be hot, but once they get to a certain point, they can't properly function anymore. They go past that point of being able to photosynthesize and they starve, you know, so we need blends that can handle these intensities. And we've really gone that way, instead of being that kind of darker, denser dwarf or, you know, most beautiful grass on the block versus having the most consistent grass on the block with good density and good utilitarian aspects to it. So it's definitely changed over time what we're using.
So, like, I mean, obviously with the pesticide restrictions and all these environmental restrictions, and you guys are adapting your blends for that, like, what are your biggest pests that you deal with on the farm for sod production?
I would say our biggest is drought. Like, drought is our biggest problem, and heat stress. Two separate things. You know, heat, what we've felt over the last few years is that, like, heat stress has kind of outweighed our drought stress. That, you know, if you go back into the records in our area here, we have not had these situations with 30, 35 degree days, you know, for 10, 15 consecutive days. Like, that's kind of unprecedented, you know, and they don't really track that the same way they do the hottest day or the coldest day. But having those consecutive days is extremely hard on plants. You know, it's like holding your breath for a minute or holding your breath for 10 minutes. And, you know, everybody can for a minute, but 10 minutes, you're dead. Well, same with a plant. You know, for a plant, you know, it can handle that 35 degree day, but it can't handle 15 of those in a row. So that has been a major.
No weeds?
Weeds, we have the proper tools to be able to deal with weeds. So it's really, that's not a major problem for us as a producer. Our regimens work. Bugs are a unique one, and, you know, to be determined exactly what our bug problem is in some areas. But it does feel like we got new bugs. We got higher populations of different grubs, you know, sod webworm, you know, different things that we haven't had in the past. And that is unique in the last, you know, decade to 5 years, that we've been finding higher populations of, you know, bill bug and sod webworm and different things that, you know, not your traditional June bug and, you know, crane fly that we're all used to dealing with in Southern Ontario here. It feels like, I don't know if it's the, you know, they're coming up and they're coming up from south, or everybody knows about the ash beetle or the ashburn beetle that killed all the ash trees. You know, that's an example of a bug that, you know, wasn't here and is now here, and our ecosystem's not capable of dealing with it properly. you know, same thing in turf grass, that we're starting to see different bugs that our varieties they haven't had to deal with in the past. So definitely new and different bugs. It hasn't been a major, I wouldn't put it on the highest level, but heat stress is a big deal. And we might go through 10 years and it not be, but it's definitely felt like over the last decade or less that things have changed to have more intense weather patterns, and having a turf grass that can handle that is priority one.
Yeah. Well, and I think any homeowner feels that with the watering restrictions that have been put in place, and also golf courses and sports fields, it's getting harder and more expensive to take water and get water taking permits. Like, this is not a problem that's going away anytime soon. So one of the questions we always ask all of our guests, what kind of advice would you give to someone who is new coming into the turf industry? Maybe they're really interested in starting a sod farm or taking over a sod farm. They're specifically interested in this. What kind of advice would you give to them?
I love it. It's a really great industry to be in. I mean, you have a meaningful purpose. I mean, as a sod farmer, I get to create green space every day and distribute green space to our urban communities. I mean, what's better than that? You know, we as us individually, we always say we're the original green company, before it used to be a keyword that everybody wanted to be affiliated with. But honestly, that's something special, you know, that you go to bed every night and you're creating green space, and in other aspects of the industry, you're managing green space for us to be in. And I think that's more important than people make it out to be. You know, from a physical and mental overall health. I mean, as individuals, we're meant to be outside and you know, be in nature. Like, you know, we're part of it, and we live such an urbanized life these days. There's so many indoor positions or office positions that, you know, it's really against our biological grain. And I think being in the turf industry and being in this industry specifically, you know, we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, and we're out there and we're working with nature. So I love that aspect. Love that aspect. And then from a career standpoint, I mean, there's lots of opportunities. I think the green space industry has seen a bit of a lack of labor force, or a lack of people getting into the industry. And if I was new getting in, I would be so excited about that. You know, going down the road that everybody else is going down the road is sure to get lost in the crowd, versus going down the road that you're the only one there. You're going to be standing out without doing anything. So I think that the opportunities are out there, and the career, the ability to move up in your career is out there in a big way in the green space world. And it's fulfilling.
For sure. Any last remarks or anything you want to plug or whatever?
Buy Green Horizons sod. Yeah. No, I think, thank you guys for having me out here. It's good to be involved in with what the GTI is doing, and anything to do with the green space industry. I mean, I hope that people find this interesting and learn a little bit about sod farming and what it takes and what it's like to be a sod farmer. Yeah. All good.
For me, I learned a ton talking with you, and I found it super interesting. So thanks for spending the time to talk with us today.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. And thanks to everyone who tuned into this episode of Canadian Turf Talks. I hope you'll join us for our next episode, where we're going to have a guest to talk about golf course architecture. And if you like what you hear, you can share us with your friends, leave us a review, or give us a like on your favorite social media. We're Guelph Turf on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, and TikTok. All right, have a great green day. This podcast is brought to you by the University of Guelph and the Guelph Turfgrass Institute.